Well, hey, good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And it's a real treat to be here with two friends, Scott Montgomery and Ace Atkins. We're going to be talking about this brand new, the latest in Akashic's really wonderful kind of trailblazing series of anthologies, Austin Noir. And Scott, you were one of the three editors on the book. And I want to ask you, you know, how that worked out, you know, kind of sharing the editing duties and how you guys did that. And of course, there's lots to talk about with Ace. I love the new story. You know, with the Quinn Coulson fans will really enjoy this connection with the new story. But Scott, do you want to kind of take the lead here? And I'll jump in with questions, you know, as I can.
Sure. I mean, I can tell you a little bit how we started. It's a book we've kind of joked a little bit that it was 10 years in the making, maybe even a little bit longer, because I was working at a bookstore with Molly Odens, one of the co-editors. And we were sitting there talking about, you know, the Akashic books, and they said, you know, they should do an Austin Noir. And that would be that conversation would happen almost, you know, once a month that would bring it up. And usually at the end of that conversation would be, oh, well, we should be the editors of the Austin Noir if they ever do it. That should be the way. And we had heard kind of stories that, no, you don't approach them, and how much of those are true or not, I'm not sure. But ended up that Molly ended up working as the one of the co-editors or co-senior editors over Crime Reads, moved to New York, got in well with a lot of the folks over at Akashic, and then kind of said, hey, can we do an Austin Noir? And she said, if I do it, she goes, I want to work with Scott Montgomery. So that... it was, I got a call, I think it was mid-March. It was kind of right when the pandemic kind of hit. And so I was at that point just sitting in my apartment, kind of working on my own writing, not doing a whole hell of a lot more. And she said, we can finally do it. Are you in? And I said, yeah. And so we rounded up a bunch of authors that we kind of knew. We knew with Akashic, they like to have diverse voices. So one of the people we knew really well was Hopeton Hay, who has basically a podcast now called Diverse Voices. And we were on his radio show a lot just at the end of the month. I was talking about crime fiction. So Hopeton kind of came aboard and helped us get some of those authors. And we just kind of basically pulled our author friends together and started working on it. That's how it started, or at least the ball got rolling.
It helped in such a great addition to y'all's team, because he is so knowledgeable about crime fiction. I've been on his show several times, and he knows the world inside out. So it's always fun talking to him. I was glad to see he was part of the whole project.
What's his podcast called? I'm going to have to look it up.
It's called Diverse Voices in Fiction, I believe. I could be wrong on that, but
he's really a terrific interviewer. I always love talking to him. He's one of those people, when you do the interview circuit, when he used to have his radio show, that he had actually read the book, which is kind of an unusual thing. He actually came like, wow, this guy, that's where I first met him. I said, this guy actually read the book. He knows it. And we became friends after that. He's a great guy.
It's refreshing. well, let's kind of kick it off just by talking about, you know, both of your connections with the city of Austin, you know, how far back that goes. And when I think of Austin, you know, I automatically, being a music person, I think of music, you know, and that's kind of my tablet or frame of reference has changed a lot too. Because at first it was, of course, Stevie Ray Vaughan and the Fabulous Thunderbirds. And now I think about, you know, some of those great kind of Texas anarchist, unclassifiable, you know, like the Rocky Erickson's and the, you know, Duck Psalm. I'm not sure. Was Psalm from Austin?
Psalm, I'm trying to think if he lived there. I know he played there a lot. He was one of Antone's, like when Clifford Antone would have his birthday party, Duck Psalm was the person who would play every night, or every birthday for him.
Right. And Jesse Sublett, you know, stuff like that. So Scott, when did... You're not from Austin originally, right? You just lived there for a while.
Yeah, I first went up there, I was 25. I'm trying to remember. It was, I believe it was a fall of 94. And it was the first year they ever had the Austin Film Festival, because that was when I got out of college. That was my plan, as I was going to be a screenwriter. And so I went there for the festival, and didn't know much about the city at the time, other than just Stevie Ray Vaughan was from there. So that's, and Willie Nelson had played there. So kind of like you, I knew the music more than anything else. And it was one of those, I'll try to put it in a nutshell, but I had an evening after the festival was over. And I thought, well, let me check out the music scene. So I went down to Sixth. And that night was what they don't really have it anymore, unfortunately. It's called Jam Session Night, where all the different bands get together. You sign up and you play with the house band for a little while. And I happened to run into this really gorgeous woman who was a singer, and she had signed up. And we hit it off, and her friend. And so, the gorgeous person was the friend. But we all hit it off. She said, well, if you haven't seen Austin here, just to follow us, and you can go in the band. So listen to the friend sing, and then danced with this gorgeous woman all night. And hearing this great music, and running into all these people, and I kind of realized, pretty much after that night, at some point I'm going to move here and live till I die. That was kind of the, and it took me about 15 years to do that, but I finally did in 07. So, and I've been here pretty much ever since. So.
What about you, Ace? What
you know, I honestly, Austin was a place that I always thought that I was going to be living in, and when I was working as a journalist down in Florida back in the 90s. There was so much that was happening in Austin, both with music, but also Robert Rodriguez and film stuff was going down, and Tarantino was there. It just seemed like the hotbed of excitement was in Austin. And my wife and I were actually on our way, I think, we were going to move to Austin. That's the ultimate destination. And about 20 years ago, I got waylaid in Oxford, Mississippi, and we never quite made it to Austin. And so over the last 15 plus years, I think I've lived vicariously through Austin, through my buddy Scott here, and, you know, coming to town and getting to know Austin just, you know, through the visits and loving the city. I also love the history of the music scene. In fact, there's a great film called Outlaw Blues from the 70s with Peter Fonda. It's terrific. And it was written by a guy that I've gotten to know that was kind of, in love with the Austin scene back in the 70s, named Bill Norton, who also wrote the film Convoy. And you get just a sense of the feeling of what Austin was like in the 70s. There was just always so much creative energy coming out. And I think, Scott, you recruited me really to write a music story with a character that I had written about that was really into Texas music and the history of the blues and that kind of thing. And I ended up doing something completely opposite as writers tend to do, which is taking one of my series characters and planting them in Austin, as had so happened in the series, not just because of this. And I wondered, once that character I had mentioned moved to Austin, what was going to happen next? And that's how the story came about for me.
And so this is Jason Coulson.
Yeah, for those of you that don't know my books, I read a character named Quinn Coulson, who very simply is a guy who's in the army. He comes back to his corrupt hometown in Mississippi and cleans it up. It's you know, my version of Walking Tall. It's a modern version of Walking Tall. But he also, my love of 1970s cinema, and I know this is what has bonded me with Scott. We love this stuff with, you know, everything from Walking Tall to Smokey and the Bandit to Hooper, those kind of films, the Hal Needham movies, is that Quinn's father was actually, who's loosely based on Hal Needham, it was a famous stuntman back in the 70s and the 80s. And throughout the series, there's 11 books in the Quinn series. There's kind of a falling out between Quinn and his dad. He ends up fixing a car, which he had actually gotten on the set of Hooper, and he drives off and he settles in Austin. And this was like, I don't know, 3-4 books back in the series. And I just didn't know how the relocation was going for him, what was happening in Austin. But I knew it wasn't going to go well, because wherever happens to Jason Coulson, he always kind of screws it up. That's kind of his MO. And so it was kind of like a little satellite project I could get for my series. And it worked out perfectly that Scott invited me to do this.
Yeah, I thought he was going to do something with... I always forget the character's name.
Travers,
yeah. And... that's what I got him for. So we didn't get music. We got Austin's film side through him. So it was fine.
Well, and also the other connection with you too, Scott, I'm sorry to break in, but there was, you also ended up getting me in touch with the director of the Austin Film Festival, mm-hmm. who set me up with a very famous stuntman named Gary Kent, who is a great source for my of writing about. I did a profile of Gary online. And so there was a lot about Gary's true life experiences that I think kind of went into this short story. And that was all through Austin. That was through you and connecting me with the director of the Austin Film Festival and meeting Gary, who was actually a famous stuntman who relocated in Austin.
And I think because of the story, I might have a weird trifecta in the Akashic ones. I'm an editor, I'm a contributor, and I'm a character in
Ace. Right. You are. And I remember when I sent you the story, you were disappointed because I put your real age in it.
Yes.
One of the things I really like about, you know, the introduction too, it says that, you know, Austin, we fear becoming Dallas.
Yes.
Yes. Well, tell us a little bit about your story, Scott.
It was weird. And this has happened a few times to where I had a story that was supposed to be for another anthology and it ended up, you know, in the next one I was working on or was asked to be a part of. And they asked me to, at one point there was somebody who was doing an anthology that was and all proceeds are going to go help clean up different rivers. So they wanted to do something with rivers. And at one point I was asked to be a part of it and it just whatever reason it didn't work out. But when he was talking to me, he goes, yeah, we'd love to have you do Austin. Maybe you could do something with the bats. And so that kind of idea was kind of in my head. And when it came around to doing it, I have a private eye character that I write about, Tin Man Timmons. And there's a book with him I'm shopping around. And then there's a short story I did called No One Owns the Blues that was originally in a thing called Eyes of Texas and was nice enough. I didn't make it in there, but I made the kind of the honorable mention of best mystery stories in America of 2020, I believe. And anyway, I thought, well, let me use Tin Man again in this. And there's a point where he has a person that helps him out a lot because Tin is not really a tough guy by any stretch of the imagination. So he has his this guy that he knows who's an ex-Marine who was in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're going to go under the bridge. And if you're not familiar with the Congress Street Bridge that's on Lady Bird Lake, it is known for the tourists go there to see the bats leave at when dusk kind of hits so they can go hunting, and then when they fly back. And it's already in the middle of the night. And what they're doing is they're going to do an exchange. There's been some, a jeweler has been broken into. The insurance company has hired them to kind of be the bagman to do the handover to where they'll take the diamonds back and they'll give money to the insurance company so they won't have to do a full payout. Well, as they're getting under the bridge, Jimmy Tin Man's side guy says, and he goes, you know, do you think the bats are all, do you think they're still out there? Are they under the bridge? And he goes, no, I think they're still out feeding. And they get into this discussion about the bats. And more you find out about this is Jimmy, this really tough ex-Marine, has a phobia against rodents, particularly bats.
Right.
And he gives a reason why. And needless to say, when the handoff comes, you hear a bunch of wings in the background and it's not our grackles, it's the bats. And kind of mayhem ensues. It was an interesting story to do because I originally was going to have the tragic part about what happened to Jimmy and his background, that be the end of it, of the story. And you kind of reading this comic story and then you find out there's a lot of tragedy in the background. And it ended up, Craig Johnson and I are really good friends. And he called me up one day and said, and I think it was about a month before we had our deadline, and said, he said his wife is going to Dallas for some business. He's going along. Can I drive up and, you know, hang out with him for the weekend? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And I said, you might take a quick look at this short story before it hits deadline. Give me some quick notes so I can polish on it. And he goes, yeah, sure. And about 2 days before we're going to meet up, he goes, I don't know if we can do anything over the weekend. He goes, I can't do anything with this short story until until we know Jimmy's story before this, all this comedy stuff happens. And I was like, well, that's not quite what I had planned the story to be. And so I thought, you know, this is Greg, let me rewrite the story. And it ended up being a much, much better story.
It was awesome. I really enjoyed it, Scott.
Thank you. Well, it was one of those weird writing things where, you know, you always learn stuff. And I kind of taught me that, you know, you want to think more about what your character needs to experience than what the reader necessarily needs to experience all the time. And that'll kind of get you there.
Right, right. You know, you were talking a little bit about, you know, about kind of spreading the net and, you know, getting contributors. And can you talk a little bit about that? Did you sort of map out the city? Because one of the things about these anthologies, you know, is that there's always in the beginning, there's a map, and you see.
And I have to say, when I got the book, that was the first thing I did was, where's my body? That was my, okay. Somebody was very familiar with it.
Yeah. So, you know, as you alluded at the beginning, you know, one of the things about this series is that they want to have a fairly, you know, accurate, semi-accurate, as accurate as possible, which is what I dealt with Phoenix Noir, you know, representation of the city, the ethnic mix and different neighborhoods and everything. Did you sort of approach different authors and say, hey, can you do a city set, you know, or a story set in this part of the city? Or how did
what we did, and we lucked out really well, because that was my biggest concern, was that somebody, you know, we'd have three people wanting to do the same section or something like that. What it kind of ended up with us was we had different waves of authors. I think we had, here's our first 15 or first 14 authors that we'd like. And then when four or five people say no, we had a couple of different waves. And I'm trying to remember who was kind of on point on that. I think it was me, because I think the first person we got was Gabino. And I said, you know, right now everything's open. So if you just tell me where you want to write it, fine, you've got it. And so he told me yes. And so then we just would go to the other authors and more or less say, okay, this place is taken, this place is taken. And so there was never any real, we never had any real problem other than there's a section, and there's two affluent sections that sound alike. And we thought one person had one and one person had the other. And we realized, no, they both had the same one. And luckily the one that was Alexandra Burt had written, there wasn't as much details of the town. She just wanted to deal with this working class woman dealing with the affluent folks that she was working for, or at least in their home. And so we were able to kind of change that without much of a problem. And Alexandra was just a trooper and a real pro. She, within less than 24 hours, like, changed it and got it to us back immediately. So, wow. So yeah, we didn't, that was, relatively easy on that side. And that was the one thing I was afraid of doing. I was surprised if nobody took a lot of the obvious places. Nobody picked Sixth Street, which I thought somebody would have. There was a couple of other, nobody picked the university in particular, but there were a lot of different, nobody picked the Capitol, which I was somewhat surprised about. So you do have like kind of definitely a working person's and citizens version, more or less, of the city, which was nice.
I'm just looking at some of the questions that are coming in. Let's see. How many authors contributed to Austin Noir?
14.
14.
Or 13 and myself. You could, however you want to look at that. So.
Right. Let's see. Robin makes the point that Ann Richards as governor brought lots of filmmaking to Austin. I didn't know that.
Yep.
Very cool.
Everybody, when I was not here during her time as governor, but you still hear everybody talk about how much they miss Anne.
Now, what about the, you know, you have it divided into three different sections. How did you come up with that organization?
That was one of the fun parts I got to do as editor, because it was one thing I had volunteered for, because I wanted to divide it up and I wanted to give the titles. And so we did basically parts of different songs, since we're music capital of the world, that's what we like to think, or live music. And so we did with some of our artists. So two of them very much deal just with what noir is in general. So we had we had, you know, a bunch of stories that dealt with fate or somebody caught in their fate. So we used Willie Nelson's Nothing I Can Do About It Now. And then, of course, the obvious one is Crossfire from Stevie Ray Vaughan. So because we have several characters that end up one way or another or something, whether realistically or metaphorically, are caught in a crossfire. And this, we might not have had this one if it was 15 years ago. But then we also went with the Gary Clark Jr. This Land, because we ended up with a bunch of short stories that were about property and what people have to do to keep their property or just living with another roommate or something like that, because that's been, we're kind of getting the same problem that San Francisco is having and some other places. In fact, that's one of the cities we keep on looking to all the time, being a little bit fearful about, and seeing just how property values are rising and how there's right. not a lot of affordable housing for even lower middle class people at this time.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, Austin's kind of experiencing a growthgasm at the moment.
Yeah.
Like a lot of cities. Ace, what have you read some of the other stories in the collection, and do you have any favorites?
Absolutely. You know, and I'm not saying this just because Scott's on here. Excuse me, I've got both allergies and a cold. Scott, I thought your story was just terrific. And I think, have you taken a boat up underneath the bridge there, or it seemed to be like a very gritty, specific place. How did you get up under there and get that sense of the nastiness
of it? I didn't take a boat. I had walked underneath of it, because you can take, like, there's a near the riverbank.
Yeah.
Or the lake bank, I should say. It used to be a part of the Colorado River, and then they dammed it up. There's a sidewalk you can kind of take under it as well. So.
And I saw a lot of, I don't know if you were going for this or whatever, but I felt a lot of Continental Op in that particular story. Is that a go-to place for you with those with those stories?
I would say this, anytime I'm writing, whether I intend to or not, probably my go-tos are Hammett and Elmore Leonard. So it's pretty much like another author I know. So
you can't go wrong with the best. They are the best. It's funny, I think you guys have both read my great friend, but also a big fan of his, is William Boyle, his novels. Yeah. And what really made me laugh, and I don't think he would mind me saying this, he is deathly afraid of bats. And I really want him to read your story. In fact, during the summertime, we actually show movies in the back of the porch at my house, and I'll put up a big screen and we have a projector and watch it. But at twilight is when the bats come out to feed, and they're all feeding. It's like a mini Austin on the back of my porch. And Bill absolutely hates it. He refuses until the bats are out of there, the darkness has fallen, twilight is gone, or whatever. So I think this story is particularly going to get to him. He's a tough guy, never known anything for, but he's like Indiana Jones with snakes. Bats and Bill Boyle do not mix. But it's a terrific story, so hats off to you, Scott.
Good. I'll tell Craig you liked it.
For sure.
Right. Well, what about some of the other contributors? We were gonna have Jeff Abbott with us tonight, but unfortunately he couldn't make it. He's a terrific writer. Really enjoyed his story too.
Yeah, I thought Jeff's was really good. And it was just that it was almost kind of like the story you hire or Jeff Abbott to do. It was so much of like, which I was happy about, to get, you know, some of, which I think, you know, was the same thing. Ace, I think that was kind of what you expect of Ace with stunts, something funny. Maybe you're a little less violent than you usually are in that short story than the other stuff.
Only, I think there's only two people get killed. So it's a little less.
So I thought that was really, and Jess is just one of those great slow burn thrillers that he can kind of do. I was, Gabino was supposed to be here, and I thought his was really wonderful. And that was kind of funny, because when we started doing this, the idea was all of us, when we were getting together to decide what authors we were going to have, trying to remember if we all pick 15 or 14, or if we like pick five, I'm trying to remember exactly, but there's a certain number. And I remember when I was putting my list together before we had the meeting, Gabino was kind of at the top of it. And I had known Gabino for years. We had been friends for at least a decade. And he had, at that time, he had just had some books that were on a small press. It was getting known. And that was the guy I was, you know, when we had this meeting, I was going to fall on my sword for Gabino. That was the Gabino Iglesias was the hill I was going to die on. And so I said, okay, so we got to have Gabino Iglesias. And both Hopeton and Molly said, yeah, okay. Okay, well, that was easy. And so when I called Gabino up, he was really thankful and really, really kind and said, oh, I'd always been wanting to be in one of the attached things. And so I was feeling so great of what a favor I had done to my friend, for my friend Gabino Iglesias, and, you know, and hopefully helping him get known a little bit more in the world of fiction. And then about a year later, Mulholland comes out with The Devil Takes You Home, and I see Gabino basically being profiled on the New York Times and winning award after award. And when I talked to him, I said, you know, I thought I was doing you the favor, but I think you're doing us the favor now. So.
He's a terrific writer. Terrific. Yeah.
Really is.
Yeah. This whole series, though, is great. I've been fortunate. It's so funny. I get spread. Let's see. I've been in I have connections to all these different places, with Florida, where I used to be a journalist for many years. I was in Tampa Bay Noir because where I'm from is, I was in Alabama Noir. I have been in New Orleans Noir with connections to my first series, and Mississippi Noir. And then now to be part of Austin Noir was just, you know, just a great addition. It's a wonderful series, and there's nothing really like it. I think for people who don't know these books, they may expect just all, you know, hard-boiled detective stories. I think we'll be pleasantly surprised. It's just, Johnny Temple does such a great job in, you know, really spreading the umbrella as far as what you might expect, you know, what is noir, and challenging those ideas. But there, you know, it's always a gas to write for any of these series. I really jump at the chance, and I was fortunate and thankful to Scott that he asked me to do it. I think I said yes immediately.
Yeah, that's one thing I've always loved about all the series. And that was one thing I was really happy about the book, the way it turned out, because I think it also helped that we did have the three of us working on it. Because if I was just the editor on it, it would have been just Scott and his drunken writer friends write some crime fiction about Austin, and that would have been it. It wouldn't have been like the Akashic Noir. Yeah. Wouldn't have had the diversity, and you wouldn't have had, which I really like about the Akashic books, is you get a really wide look at that city, of whatever it happens to be, or sometimes that subject and all of its different facets. And then just the genre itself, kind of like you were saying, it's like you know, both Ace and I have very funny stories. There's another, Andrew Hilbert, who's a fantastic local author, has a really hard satirical one. There's one of my favorites in there is Charles Bronson by Lee Thomas, who's really kind of known more in the horror scene. And the LGBTQ scene too of writing, and he gave a very dark kind of, you know, really like probably one of the truer noir stories that are in there. And then we had some people who had never worked in the genre, and it was interesting to see what they had done with it too.
Yeah, I think one of the things so cool, several years ago, I had the really great fortune of getting to meet and hang out with Anthony Bourdain, who is just an amazing person and a huge crime novel fan. He just absolutely loved crime novels. And he said that when he would travel to these different places, the way that he would get to know a city, a place he'd never been, is to find out who their local crime writers were. And that's how he would explore a city. He said that was his entry into Havana, was to find out who was writing crime fiction in Havana. That's where he would find out really how the best way to know a city. And I think that's so accurate. I think it's so true. And I think when you get these books, it's vicariously traveling to these places and getting to know more about not just the city, but all these different neighborhoods and all these different places. It's really lovely.
Yeah, you really get a street level view of sort of what's going on in American cities in general, you know, well, world cities, you know. There's tons of interesting social history kind of tucked into a lot of the stories. And I like sort of the mix of, you know, maybe have a historical piece about, you know, historical you know, aspect of the city.
I gave my co-editors, the one I did, I gave them two choices, and one I did was more of a Western in some ways. It was 1870s and dealt with one of our gunfighter marshals, Ben Thompson.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. Because he had caused so much trouble that they said, well, let's just make him marshal, and that way they'll be just, one, he'll scare everybody else off, and two, anything illegal he'll be doing, he'll just be shooting another gunfighter, so that'll be fine. And he had this really interesting backdrop, and oddly enough, there was him with his violent past, but then there was his brother Billy, who apparently was the crazy one. And he had owned a gambling hall that was near what's actually just right down Congress Avenue. I think it's where the Stephen F. Austin Hotel is now. And anyway, but he was a silent partner since he was marshal. So I have these guys rob it without realizing who they've actually stolen money from. And they get kind of chased out of town and up north into Round Rock. So.
You know, see, Scott, there's just so many entry levels into Austin, whether historic or, yeah. You know, like I was talking about the, you know, in fact, one of the ideas I was kicking around was doing a story about the bar scene in the 70s and all the blues players that were coming around, and, you know, what those kind of, you know, rough clubs were like, you know, back in the early days. I mean, there's all these different places to go into, but it's just endlessly fascinating, from the music to the movie scene, to the history, to the Old West. You know, we go, and you and I have been many times hanging out at the Driscoll bar up there, and that place has been open, what, for, you know, 1870s,
I think. Yeah, it was actually done, in fact, it was opened by a rancher that wanted a place for his cowboys when they would come back after.
And it's a gorgeous hotel, and it's I love going there and staying there. And, you know, it has a marble, beautiful marble entryway. And then there's a second floor, you know, cattle baron bar. And you said it. And in fact, I just was working on an old story of mine and retooling it. I ended up being gravitated to write the final scene back at the Driscoll bar, because it's just such a crazy place, you know, with the, you know, it's got the, you know, I don't know if they're Frederick Remington, but Remington-esque, you know, statues and the paintings on the wall. And, you know, it's just a storied city, and you can just get through it so much. And it's a shame, like what you're talking about, the transition and the gentrification. And then, of course, always what you see is, you know, keeping the funkiness and keeping Austin weird, which it seems to getting harder and harder for you guys. But, you know, I think this book is maybe the celebration of the weirdness.
It is true. Well, I think we kind of saw it as a celebration of the us that are the holdouts, that are sticking around and plan to be, you know, at least stay here as long as we possibly can and kind of keep it as much the city that we love. And, you know, I sit there and gripe about it, you know, every day, but then I'll go out, I'll hit the streets or go just somewhere. And, I was telling, since we're both a big fan of the movie, I was telling Ace about a month ago, I was standing in line at a gas and sip, and I had my hat, which is like a very, very dark blue hat, a black jeans, and then had like a dark blue shirt on or something like that. And a woman stopped by and said, hi. And then she looked up and she goes, God, I love a man who dresses like Billy Jack, and then walked over. And so I didn't get those interactions when I was living in LA or when I was back home in St. Louis. And so that always kind of reminds me that no, there's still folks that are like that. And we were talking about history, and we also mentioned Jesse Sublett earlier. Two really great books he's done that's about kind of our notorious past. Did one called 1960s Austin Gangsters, and then a follow-up called Last Gangster in Austin, which kind of deals with the 70s. And they're both a really great look at that time. And
definitely. Jesse is amazing, and he's such a great guy too. I think one of the most fun, you know, some of the most fun times I've had is, you know, coming into Austin and meeting up with Scott and, you know, doing a book signing and a talk or whatever, and Jesse would end up playing. And, you know, he's such a, you know, great professional musician. The fact that he'd show up at one of my book signings and play some really deep cut death blues and that kind of stuff. And then talking about, you know, the history of movie making is when we go over to the Chili Parlor, where, you know, Death Proof was filmed, the Tarantino short, And, you know, it was just like, it was terrific. What's not to love about Austin? You know, it's everything I like, music and books and movies and history.
Is the Continental Club in Austin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was the first music venue I ever went to. And then the first Noir at the Bar we ever did was with Jesse and a couple of people in it was at a kind of above their room.
I kind of expected a Jesse story in here. Did you approach him or?
We did. In fact, he was I don't know if you had this problem, but I've talked with every other with all the other editors of the Akashic Books, City Books. He was somebody we had, and then he had just everything kind of was happening in his life. In fact, he had to move to LA for a little while and then became a grandfather. And between all of that, he unfortunately had to bow out. So in fact, that's how we kind of ended up having Molly also be one of our contributors. So yeah, we're really kind of sad to lose him because he was going to do something that was going to be at South Congress and deal with the music scene. So, and that was the only thing I kind of...
Have you met him, Patrick? Have you crossed
paths? Yeah, I haven't really hung out too much, man.
He's a very cool dude.
I met him when he came out with that really great memoir that he did about his Never the Same. About his cancer and recovery and punk rock and all kinds of great stuff. Now, and he came out here and I got a chance to hang out with him a little bit, but yeah, he seems like my kind of guy.
Yeah, we're lucky because with the Noir at the Bar that we always do here, like we're doing it every 2 months at this place called Vintage. That's a bookstore / wine bar, and Jesse's always been kind enough to go, and he'll do a reading, but beforehand he'll play 3 or 4 songs. In fact, last time he brought a stand-up bass and played for us.
Oh, really?
That's awesome. Yeah, every time I go to Austin, have a great time. Scott and I usually hit, some great barbecue while we're there. We'll find some great either music place that's what's really happening. Great, where do we go before to go see Chris Knight? Where was that at the beer hall, Scott?
Oh, was that Green Hall that we mentioned?
Green Hall. We went out to Green Hall where Willie Nelson used to play and all the greats, and saw a couple of great bands there. And then if the bands aren't happening, is to go to Alamo Draft House, and we saw Big Trouble and Little China's playing. I mean, it's just great. I know why you live there and why you love it, and it's a shame I never ended up there to live because it just seems like there's something going on every night.
Other than it speaks to Ace's cachet is when we went to see Chris Knight in Green Hall when it was either during intermission or at one point we were standing there and one of the guys that was kind of rocking out to the music came up to Ace and goes, "You're Ace Atkins, aren't you? Man, I really dig your books." And I was like, wow, it's like even go to Green Hall at a honky tonk on a Saturday night, Ace can still be the rock star there too. So
that was my cousin.
Right.
Yeah, we had a great time. We always have a great time in Austin. It's just I think that's a great thing, is like when I'll come in to see you, Scott, and you pick me at the airport and we go hang out, there's always something. There's always something, like who shows, Big Trouble in Little China on film, you're watching it on film. And then, then to be able to go and see, all these great shows, and they're just, an endless picking of talent and entertainment and art is just all around. And I think that's probably where you guys are now and the precipice of, you can't keep a good thing quiet. Everyone wants to live there.
Well, I think one of when I mentioned the Lee Thomas story, he has probably my favorite line in the book. And I think it's something we wrestle with a lot is that he says, this town used to be cool. Now it's just popular. And I think a lot of us are feeling at this point.
Well, you guys need to go back and watch this film called Outlaw Blues with
Peter. Yes.
And if you want to see when Austin was really cool and really crazy, it was like 1977. And I think it's Susan St. John is in it.
She's really good at it too.
Oh,
really?
She's terrific. And you got all these people living on their houseboats and jamming at these local bars. And I forget there was a famous club, Scott. I can't remember the name of it, but it was a very famous blues club that was open where a lot of guys were playing back in the 70s.
I think there's a point to where they're at Shoal Creek where he's playing.
I think there's a place that was the place where allegedly one of the places, or the really kind of rough club, and Pink Floyd try to get in, but like they couldn't name a Howlin' Wolf song, and so they were turned away.
It might have been Armadillo. I don't think Anton's which was the big club, had been in there yet.
So much history.
Songwriters is a great movie too, to see like Austin and Hayday with Chris Christopherson and Willie Nelson.
I haven't seen that. When is that? Is that from the 70s or 80s?
It's from the 80s, and a lot of it's about deals a lot with Willie Nelson and why he kind of left Nashville and ended up in Austin in a way. It's a great
look. What about this? That sounds fantastic.
And a guy I thought I might have gotten to do Austin 1, it fell through, I can't believe I'm blanking his name, the lead singer of Asleep at the Wheel, Ray Benson. Wow. There was a chance because one time Hillary Davidson, the crime author, she was doing an event and her husband was with us. And we all went out to dinner later on. And anyway, we were sitting there talking. And anyway, he looked at his phone. Her husband said, "Oh, it looks like he's coming over." And she goes, "Oh, yeah." She goes, "My husband's cousin is in a band here." And I was like, "Well, whose cousin isn't in a band here in Austin?" So and then we were talking a little bit more. And she goes, "Are you familiar with Asleep at the Wheel?" I'm like, "Yeah, they're one of the reasons I moved out here." She goes, "Yeah, his cousin's Ray Benson." And all of a sudden, this six and a half foot guy kind of walks in and he starts talking about working with Willie Nelson. And so we were trying to get him and her to do a story together, and it unfortunately didn't work out.
Wow. Now, when I think of I like Townes Van Zandt. Is he more associated with Houston than, or is he just kind of all over Texas?
I think he's considered all over. I mean, we definitely claim him. I mean, we kind of claim Steve Earle, other than I think Steve Earle kind of is more or less not claim Texas anymore.
There was a great documentary, by the way. What do you remember seeing it, Ace, about the... it had very young Steve Earle and Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark. And I think.
Oh, Heartworn Highways.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. That's really
good. There's one great night. We ended up in Green Hall, I guess, and we saw Ray Wiley Hubbard, and he's a good friends with Scott and invited us up to talk to him between the sets and everything. And I think he's a big crime novel fan, isn't he? Doesn't he buy a lot of crime books or did?
Yeah. Well, in fact, I'll try to make it a quick story. I can't believe I'm getting older, I'm blanking names. Wrote The Prophet, used to be a private eye writer. I mean, private eye, and then ended up writing books. Prophet was one of his books. Trying to think. This is killing me.
Not Joe Gores.
No. No, much younger. Shoot, they just turned one of his movies a couple of years back into a movie with Angelina Jolie. This is terrible.
Oh, Michael Caruita.
Yeah, Michael Caruita.
Yeah, of course.
He was a big Ray Wiley Hubbard fan, and there was a mix-up where he was supposed to join us for dinner with Ray, and that unfortunately he went one place and we didn't know he was there. And Ray and the rest of us went to another one. And so I had to hear the next time he came in about how we abandoned him when he thought he was going to hang out with Ray Wiley Hubbard. And I said, I know Ray. Let me see if I can get him to come to our, we were doing a special Noir at the Bar event. Anyway, couldn't get him there. And I was like, damn, that's too bad. And I was walking out of the store and I hear this voice. I'm like, what are the odds? I look over and Ray's there with his son. And I said, are you here for a moment? I said, I just want to introduce you to somebody. And I went over to Michael and I said, hey, I said, do you mind talking with this one person? I think you'd be interested. And so he went just full fanboy in front of Ray Wiley Hubbard. And Ray said, he goes, yeah, I can't make the thing you're doing tonight. We're playing. He goes, but when are you guys done? And I said, we're probably wrapping around 8:30. He goes, I'll be on for another hour. He goes, come over to the venue. He goes, I'll have you on the guest list. You'll sit with my wife and my daughter, and you can at least hear the last half of the show.
That's great.
And this whole time, I kept on hearing from Michael about how, you abandoned me the last time. I could have met Ray Wiley Hubbard and all of you guys, and And I was apologizing the whole time. And then so anyway, it wasn't the prophet, but we'll say it's the prophet since I can't remember the title of it. When we get there near the end of the concert, and he basically plays the five Ray Wiley Humber songs you want to hear, but then he goes into this blues number and just cranks it out, goes into this big great guitar solo, and then gets slower, and it's just him on the guitar, and there's Denton, just him, and it gets a little bit mover, and we're north of Lady Bird Lake or the Colorado, and he goes, you know what? He goes, want to tell all you people tomorrow night or tomorrow morning? He goes, you get yourself up in the morning, you go across that water over there over to Book People, and he goes, you buy this new book by Michael Corita. He goes, I've just read the first four chapters. Wow. And then all of a sudden the band breaks out. It goes, you know, full on and full tilt. And I just remember looking at Mike and I said, okay, I don't want to hear another word about this.
That's cool.
I think somebody like Ray Wiley Hubbard, that's really kind of the cross section of like music and noir and everything. I
mean, yeah.
You know, maybe terrible to say, but I actually like his version of Choctaw Bingo probably better than McMurtry's. I know that's terrible to say, but he does a killer version. But I mean, it's all the same, man. You know, it's all noir, it's all the feeling, it's all. And I mean, I've learned, as we've talked about many times, you know, as much from musicians as I have from writers, and you know, that feeling and that sense of what is noir. The buddy of mine here named Joe Atkins, who's a professor here at Ole Miss, always says, you know, the definition of noir, he said, is like the Supreme Court's definition of pornography.
Yeah.
You know it when you see it. And then that's kind of, you know it when you feel it with noir, and it could be music or movies or books or whatever, but that's the, it's a sense of, you know, that foreboding. But yeah, you got it locked. You got a lot of it in Austin for sure.
I was like the Eddie Muller, one of his definitions, about people taking the shortcut to the American dream, because I think that allows you so much.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a good, there's a question which we should, yeah, we could talk about this for a few minutes here. Robin says, I thought the writers were locals from each city in these anthologies. Not sure where I got that impression. That's an interesting thing, because in a lot of them, it's, you know, it's a combination, you know, of local. I remember when I did the Phoenix Noir anthology, you know, there's a certain, you want to get a couple of really well-known writers, frankly, yeah, just to, you know, for the commercial hook, but also that was fun putting that together, getting a lot of local writers, and also getting an outside perspective is also very valuable.
Yeah.
Don't you find?
Yeah, and that was, in fact, one of the people I was kind of lobbying for and was Jim Fasilli, because I know, one, I know he was going to write, and then he's always down here for South by Southwest, so it would have been interesting to get somebody who's a music insider but not a musician to kind of get their take on it, particularly, you know, if he wrote about that particular time, because that's...
I like his books. He's kind of... Haven't seen much from him in recent years, but
no, I think he's just doing a lot of I think film criticism now, when I last talked to him, and he's been doing a lot with, I guess, the books that he has written have been doing well enough with his other income to kind of support him and kind of do what he wants to do. So
right.
Yeah, I know he's still around. We kind of talk now and then, but that was somebody I was kind of hoping. Yeah, actually, Ace is the only non-Austin native or person who hadn't lived, actually has never been a resident in Austin that we.
But I have had probably more alcohol in Austin than all the local writers combined, and so that's what actually made me eligible to be a part of this.
That's so cool. Now, is Austin kind of? Is it a city that sort of values its historic buildings and heritage? I know Phoenix, we've lost so many of our old buildings. And
it's, I you know, my fear is it's getting less and less so. And I do want to say it's a, you know, I still live here. It's a town I still love, and there's enough to remind me why I love it here. We used to have a law here that you couldn't build a building that would block the view of the Capitol, and that law got taken down about a decade ago. The running joke that's been here is the state bird is the crane, because there's always something being built and another skyscraper or something like that. So, and we've we talk about the music venues. There were some that I was really surprised that some of those are no longer around, that whatever just high rent didn't knock out, the pandemic kind of took care of. So
yeah, that pandemic was really tough on working musicians and venues.
We lucked out with one of ours, the Saxon Pub, which was going to move to a different location. It is nice. There is a developer here. I don't know what his, I forget his name, but what they're trying to do is kind of raise money to keep some of the older things around and in places, particularly that are still, you know, a part of the community, like some of our music venues and things like that. So.
Robin wants to know, is Dance Across Texas still there?
That's a good, you know what? I don't know. I almost want to say it probably is not at this point, because I have not seen it in a while, so, or even heard it talked about. So there's a good chance it is probably no longer there.
Right. Well, before we wrap it up, maybe just ask Ace, I know you have a new book that you're in the editing stage now, right? It's finished. And
I do. I've got a new book that'll be out not till next July, not till July 2024 from William Morrow. And I'm very excited about it. So I'm on the last bit of it, doing a little bit of editing. And then I'm excited to finally get back in bookstores.
Is there anything you can say about the new book or no?
Yeah, no, I'd be glad. I'd be glad to talk about it. Are you kidding me? I've been, as you know, Patrick, for the last, 10, 11 years have been alternating two series, where I do one that is deep in Mississippi with Quinn Colson, and then I do stuff with Robert B. Parker Spencer. And I've been doing that for over a decade. And so it was really about trying to do something new and trying to branch out and doing something that was, some of the projects that had been kind of stacking up in the queue, things that I knew, that I needed to tackle and get into. And this was one of the stories I've been wanting to write for some time. And I'm so happy to see it finally get on the page. We do not have a title yet. The title is still up for discussion. A lot of titles bouncing around, but it's a crime novel set in Memphis. And basically it's a story about a woman that's husband has disappeared, and she hires a very famous, very locally known private investigator that has been around back since the early 1970s to look into what happened to her husband. And she finds out her entire life is a lie, and her husband is not an upstanding member of the Better Business Bureau, but is actually international arms dealer. And then the fun begins from there. It's a dark comedy, and it's the kind of book I've been wanting to write for some time, and I'm excited for it to finally get out there, in next year.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah,
great. What about you, Scott? What do you have? What are you working on at the moment?
I'm doing the last touches on a rewrite of a novel I have called Dorothy and the Tin Man, which features the detective that's in Austin Noir, and then working on a short story. In fact, two short stories. One, the one that didn't get into the anthology that I talked about. As I've been saying with my history, there's a magazine looking for Western, so I'm kind of doing that, and then taking a title from Elmore Leonard and turning that into a short story. I'm doing a lot of research on the Apache, because he said something that he took a lot of stuff from Hemingway. He goes, that guy was doing this. I was doing the same guy thing he was kind of doing. He goes, my men were up in the mountains with rifles. So it's all I know right now really is that it deals with the Apache, and the title is Up in the Mountains with Rifles. So I'm doing that. And then I've got a website that I launched not too long ago called The Hard Word, to where I do interviews with authors, both in Western fiction and crime fiction, and do reviews of what's coming out. And we'll hopefully do some kind of special historical things too about some books that might not have, that have kind of fallen through the cracks, and also kind of doing a craft question each month with a series of authors.
Have you talked to Lauren Estelman? I think he's like a national treasure. You know, I love his books, love his historicals as well.
Yeah, that's somebody I would love to. He's one of those guys I just love, who did, you know, like Leonard and Pranzini and those guys.
Yeah.
Who, and then one of my favorite guys who was kind of known as the king of the paperbacks, but those guys that just were able to go back and forth between genres, I really, really admire a lot.
Oh, Esselman's great, man. He's one of the best.
And he took some, I mean, something from each genre and kind of put, you know, he took his Private Eye series kind of has a little bit of a Western element to it, and all of the Westerns have a little bit of a noir or kind of hard-boiled.
He's terrific.
Vibe to it.
Yeah, I don't know if he's done an Apache novel. I don't think so.
No, this is good. I've done some Western scripts, and I've usually used, you know, like the Sioux, kind of the more the Northern tribes. So this is, it's kind of interesting doing the research right now that I'm doing.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, it's been a delight talking with you both, as always.
Same here.
And we've been talking about this book, Austin Noir, just out. Buy a copy today. And guys, have a great evening. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And as I said before, this is such an honor. Poison Pen is one of the best known bookstores when it comes to crime fiction. So it's so honored to be in your store, and then for you guys to interview me, us. It means a lot. So thank you.
Thanks so much. All right, everybody. Thanks for watching online too. And
take care. Thanks for tuning in.
Sounds
good. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks. Take care. Talk to you soon.
Cheers.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.